ballots. These ballots could come in a week or 3 weeks after Election Day. They can be voted after Election Day, and it doesn't matter. And that is either because they are intentionally misrepresenting the truth, or they have been lied to so often by Donald Trump that they don't understand it. These ballots have been timely received, okay? The ballots we're talking about in Pennsylvania, they have come in before or on Election Day. There is no, these are not ballots that possibly could have been voted after Election Day. They have been received already. So the issue with the date is not the date upon which they were voted. The only dating issue here is the date on the outer envelope filled in by the voter. So the date is doing literally no work, because the election officials in the counties, they are date stamping when the counties receive the ballots with an official date stamp. So there's no question that these ballots were voted on time.
So these fields are only there specifically so that if you mess up, it gives Republicans a predicate to then try to throw them away. They are there as a trap, baby, basically, like a booby trap to confuse people or to have them do something wrong so that that can be used as justification to then undermine these ballots.
Yes. Look, a lot of these traps go back to a different era, decades ago, when people were, in fact, signing things and dating next to it. I'm sure everyone's filled out a form where you have to put your signature and date something. And you may ask yourself, why the hell do we still have to do that, since most of these documents are now like put in, you know, either DocuSign or Adobe Acrobat or something that locks an electronic date that is unchangeable. And it's just because we have not caught up in a lot of our antiquated forms with the new realities. And that's the situation here. The counties know when they receive these things. There may be a postmark from the Postal Service, but even if there's a postmark from the Postal Service, they are still hard date stamping them when they are received by the counties. So the dating here is just an anachronism from another era. It is doing no work, and all it is doing is disenfranchising voters. But the question, Brian, is why are Republicans looking for excuses to throw out votes? Because that's the reality of where we are. In state after state, whether it's Pennsylvania or someplace else, we talk about this every week. Republicans have another scheme to throw out otherwise lawful votes.
I do want to talk about your firm's work in the federal case that's similar to this one. But before we do, just a note for everybody watching, if you want to support the invaluable work that Mark and his team are doing in the courts, which is ground zero in the fight to protect democracy right now, a small step that we can all take is signing up for Democracy Docket. It's the news outlet Mark founded to focus on everything voting and elections. It's a resource I use on a daily basis. It's super helpful. So I'll put the link right here on the screen and also in the post description of this video. So Mark, can you talk about the lawsuit that your firm is working on in the federal courts that's similar to this one in PA?
Yeah, so there have been several lawsuits, as people probably know, on this issue or related issues that have percolated up and down the various courts around Pennsylvania. One of those cases is a case, as you mentioned, my law firm is involved in for parts of the Democratic Party in federal court that say that these requirements violate the U.S. federal constitution. This is in state court saying it violates the state constitution. I believe it violates both the state and federal constitution because, it, you know, however you look at it, you're potentially disenfranchising, or not potentially, you are in fact disenfranchising people. They are U.S. citizens. They are properly registered. They are eligible to vote. They haven't cast another ballot. There is nothing wrong with the ballot inside the envelope. It is perfectly cast. And yet they are seeing their ballots thrown in the trash. They are suffering the indignity of being disenfranchised because of the antiquated dating form on the outer envelope. And so whether it's this case in state court or the federal court case, this courts need to protect these voters.
Right. And I know that we don't think of it this way, but this is just a modern version of a poll tax or having to choose how many jelly beans are in a jar. I mean, this is not much different because there is no prohibition in the Constitution to voting if you haven't properly dated the outside envelope. I mean, this is just some new obstacle that they've created to prevent
people from
voting.
There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you have to know the date in order to vote.
Right.
And no less, not only know the date, but interpret the form where there's a place for a date. Interpret it that what they mean is the date you signed. as opposed to the date of the election, as opposed to your birth date, which are, by the way, other dates that that Republicans in other states, you know, the birth date, some places they do want you to have your birth date. So you know, there is this, it should, there is nothing in the right to vote that is conditioned on being able to interpret this form and knowing the date. You should be allowed to vote even if you don't know what day the date is.
Thank you for listening.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arshan Das, with my co-host,
Kate Smiggy.
And today we're going to be interviewing Max Gonzalez, also known as Gems.
Hi.
Max is a graffiti artist and muralist in Pittsburgh. He has a pretty interesting story. So I guess we'll let him lead it off. Tell us how you got into graffiti.
Yeah. So I am a full-time muralist, but I always make the distinction to say that I'm like first and foremost a graffiti writer. So like I have a very like graffiti, like traditional hip-hop lettering background. I'm originally from Southwest Side Chicago. I grew up painting there and just like seeing like graffiti everywhere I was from, because the neighborhood I'm from is Pilsen, and it's just like this very historic Chicano community that's just covered in graffiti. So I just naturally saw it everywhere I was. So even like as far as like starting to draw graffiti, like I don't even know how old I was, because I just was mimicking what I saw and what I thought graffiti was. I very much so have always had graffiti in my life. I didn't really start to like try to actually paint and get a name in graffiti until I was about like 15. I think like the first time I used spray paint though, I was like 13, just coming from like a construction background and doing vandal type things with my dad and my brother. And from there, around like later in high school is when I started to actually really try to push it more, try to do pieces and things. But it really was when I moved to Pittsburgh for college and didn't have like parental control and kind of had free reign that I really, really started to push graffiti. So that was like age 18. I started writing Gems. Before that, I was writing all kinds of other things, but Gems is like really what stuck out to me. And just like being in a university format in a city that was unfamiliar to me and just kind of hating the college format I was in, I kind of didn't like to hang around a lot. So every night I would just go paint on things and put my name everywhere. So in a way, like me having graffiti was an access to like my upbringing to Chicago and kind of like that culture that I was brought up with. So being able to like export that to Pittsburgh and like pull from that inspiration. But so the whole time through college, I was not doing graffiti as my art form for Carnegie Mellon, but it was still always there.
Yeah, so you studied at Carnegie Mellon, like we are current Carnegie Mellon students. A lot of times when you're around campus, you hear people talking about how the environment here is somewhat depressing or suffocating. Everyone has their own opinions on that, but how do you think the environment of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon contributed to your art?
Yeah, if anything, it was kind of good that I had such a distaste for CMU, just because it forced me to seek like the actual Pittsburgh communities outside of the campus areas. Just because, I don't know, like coming from where I'm from, like I'm not poor or anything, but I come from a working class family and like work construction my whole life. So coming here and like even during school, like working two different jobs, like working at a restaurant and then like working construction during the summers, like I just couldn't really culturally attach myself to a lot of the other people here, where I was just seeing people who literally princes and princesses, and I was just kind of like, oh my god, and like children of like CEOs, and it just like was very difficult for me to attach myself to that, especially coming from like Chicago and kind of loving the more city nitty gritty side of things. So that did push me to eventually start looking into seeing the rest of the East End. So really, I've always like prided myself on like being very attached to the East End of Pittsburgh. So like East Liberty, Bloomfield, Garfield. And from there, finding places like Time Bomb Shop, which used to be on Highland Ave, which is like a historic hip-hop graffiti store, and Daily Bread, and finding all those friends there. Thank you to CMU for pushing me away.
I think it's sometimes great on artistic journeys to find inspiration from life and to find inspiration sometimes from those struggles that you face. And I feel like that's the uncomfortable part of the artistic journey. But when you're creating graffiti, what are you thinking about in terms of style and colors? Like, what do those artistic choices look like? Or do you come up with a design beforehand?
I mean, I would say there's definitely a distinction for me between like my graffiti and my muralism or spray can muralism. As far as graffiti inspiration, like letters, a lot of the inspiration for me does come from Pittsburgh. It wasn't until I moved to Pittsburgh that I had people who were willing to critique my style and tell me like that I sucked for the first time. And I was like, oh, wow, like I just assumed because I know how to draw, I must be good at graffiti. And it's kind of like, well, no, like graffiti is a typographic art form. It's based in lettering and this long history of hip hop, even predates hip hop. And so I can't reinvent something that's already been mastered and that has a super strong history tied to it. It'd be wrong for me to reject the culture that it comes from young black and brown kids from New York and Philadelphia. Yeah, so I'm always looking to that as a reference point, like original subway graffiti, just wall graffiti. As far as like what I'm contributing to my style writing, and even in my murals, I try to push for there to be as much of a graffiti presence as possible. So any point that I get to introduce traditional graffiti styles into my art, I'd gladly accept it.
It's interesting that you mentioned the different scenes that exist in graffiti from different cities. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the regional differences that exist between what you saw in, say, Chicago and here in Pittsburgh? And how does that influence your style?
Yeah, there absolutely is like a huge distinction between different cities' graffitis, graffiti styles. Like I even said, like there's a little bit of a contention between who started modern style writing, whether it was Philadelphia or New York, but they both started around the same time in the late 60s. Philadelphia has a very, very distinct style for their like very tall, elongated letters. Even all of their like pieces look like that. It's called a style called Wickeds. And it's just like this very, very gestural style that you probably couldn't even read if you weren't from Philadelphia. Where New York is known for like these rounder, more funky styles. And even being that Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, they're in the same state. Yes, they're opposite ends. It's just interesting to note that Pittsburgh does not have a Philadelphia style. Pittsburgh has a bit of his own style. Kind of with the advent of Instagram and the internet, styles have started to be diluted a bit. Philadelphia still has its style, but all the styles are kind of meshing a lot. The one thing with Chicago's style is that it actually kind of is very similar to LA's style because of a history of a Chicano and Cholo movement there, where a lot of the original graffiti from LA is referencing kind of like old English styles, and a lot of gangbangers from back then would be riding in that style. So even before style riding was a thing that existed. So a lot of these almost gothic, pointy, like very aggressive-looking styles of graffiti were present in L.A., and being that there was a large movement of Chicano and Cholo people in Chicago and kind of like migration between the two places, they share that style. Where definitely, though, if you go to the south side of Chicago, it's a lot more noticeable, where the north side, it's just kind of like a contemporary mix of all styles. Chicago definitely would not have its style if it wasn't for the Mexican-American culture that's present there. Pittsburgh, being that it has zero Mexican-American culture, besides like me and two other people, it was more receptive towards like funky styles, but also like hardcore punk styles.
Do you think, is there anything about placement of the actual lettering that differs in cities, or is it just styles? Like, are there certain places where people tend to tag more often than others based off of regional differences, or have you not seen that?
Yeah, it definitely is a regional thing where, so even when I first moved here, I was like, oh my God, no one here paints rooftops really. Where I love rooftops, and rooftops are super common in Chicago, where you just like climb up a roof and find a sidewall and like paint something up there. Where, yeah, that was like one of my favorite challenges is like finding a roof. And one thing I was taught by one of my friends is like, you can always find a way up onto that rooftop. Just like if you give up, then you failed. It's just like there's always a way. So it taught me to climb really well. I can't climb as well as I used to, though. But even if you go to New York or Philadelphia, a lot of box trucks are painted. That hasn't caught on in other cities like Pittsburgh, just because it kind of would take an overnight shift of like everyone painting box trucks for it to not stick out like a sore thumb. So yeah, it's just kind of, people have always painted those. Pittsburgh doesn't have subway cars. We have the T, and that actually was painted once at one point, and everyone got arrested. Pittsburgh is actually a bit well known for its like freight graffiti, like freight trains. So it was like people like Prism, Nexky, others from that era, from like NSF crew, who started pushing freight graffiti super heavily. And unfortunately, because Pittsburgh's lost a lot of its industry, a lot of our freights have gone too. So we've definitely fallen from the ranks as being like a freight graffiti city, just because we don't have those surfaces quite as much anymore. But there still absolutely is that history there. But yeah, other cities, like if you go to like LA or Chicago, people love to wild out there, and people love to paint the fronts of like more corporate or franchised businesses. So like a Dunkin' Donuts or a Subway, or just kind of like a Motorola store or whatever, just kind of like blast it. And like, and it gets removed very quickly, but it's just kind of like this more lawless, reckless style out there.
Yeah. So kind of on that topic, I would be interested to hear a little bit more about the legal challenges to graffiti and whether or not you think graffiti can be positive or negative for a community, and what are some of the effects of it?
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes people will bring up the argument like, is graffiti vandalism? And it's like, yes, absolutely. Of course it's vandalism. But I don't think vandalism is a disqualifier for something being art. Just because something is illegal doesn't mean it can't be art. If anything, a lot of art is born from illegal activities or what might have been illegal at that point. I don't think it would be best to tell anyone like, yeah, all laws are off and go paint whatever you want. But usually what the best situation for graffiti is when the graffiti writers and the community have a common dialogue. So the more that the graffiti writers can see themselves as a part of the community, the less they see themselves as the villain. So the more that the community says, you guys are the evil graffiti villains, and vilify that person, the more they'll say, yeah, you know what, I am awful and I'm going to ruin your day. There are unspoken rules in graffiti where it's like, don't go over places of worship, no places of education, no playgrounds, no cemeteries, not the front of anyone's house. But yeah, it's a lot of times when you see people doing vandalism or what we call civilian graffiti on places that it shouldn't be, or that are like very destructive and inconsiderate to a community, it's typically not a person that is from the graffiti writing community. It's someone that is some kid or some adult or some drunk adult that is just out there seeking to destroy something in that one moment, and they might not ever do graffiti ever again in their life. So a lot of those incidents do give graffiti a bad rap. And really with graffiti, it's no one's out there thinking or saying, I want to go paint racial slurs or something like awful or make someone feel bad. It's, here's my identity. I've developed this name into my identity. I'm proud of this identity. Or even in Pittsburgh, a lot of the queer and furry communities have started taking up graffiti a lot. And I see that as like a very obvious sign of like agency over identity, where even for furry communities and queer communities, being a furry, that is agency over identity. Choosing a different name for a queer person, it's writing your own narrative and deciding how it's being told, and in what visual aesthetics it's being told in. So graffiti is just the same, where if I want to put up the name Gems Everywhere and I'm doing this very specific style, these very specific locations with the specific character, that's how you're wanting to be interpreted by the community. And even if you go back to the origins of graffiti, it really was disenfranchised youth who didn't see their voice out there in the world. Graffiti's always been around. It always will be around. Even if you go back to caveman times, there's always been graffiti. Roman times, were always scribes into walls. And a lot of those scribes, you'd expect them to be some sort of romantic poetry, but a lot of them are just kind of like jokes and stuff like that. And like saying like, Pythagoras sucks. And like, I guess that'd be Greek. But yeah, so it's just kind of like learning to have a community dialogue and opening up more spaces to graffiti or sanctioned graffiti spaces. People being less afraid of letters.
Going off of that, do you think there is a distinction between murals and graffiti, or do you think people make that distinction because of the way they see graffiti, trying to separate the two, even though they're kind of similar art forms?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of language in the world of graffiti that is kind of difficult to even understand. Or even if you notice, I've been saying graffiti writer. When I'm saying graffiti writer, that's someone who does traditional hip-hop style writing. So you're writing your name on the wall. Where one distinction I make and a lot of graffiti writers make is that graffiti art typically is the form of graffiti that is done with permission, or that's sanctioned, or it's a commission. So it can still be hip-hop letters, like it can still be your name, but it was just that it was done legally. Where graffiti, it sometimes gets like misused in the way that someone will call anything done with spray paint graffiti, and it's like, well, no, it's not like traditionally tying itself to style writing. Where some people see the term graffiti as an insult, and it's like, no, it's just like, it's just a style. Where one distinction I make is just like, I usually just refer to murals or my murals as like spray can art murals, where it's just spray can art. And there's even a book from the 80s called Spray Can Art that is, a good reference point too, just for learning a lot about graffiti. But even the term street art is very loaded. Street art comes after graffiti. Street art is actually a byproduct of graffiti and was made by graffiti writers, where street art more so often refers to wheat pasting, stencils, and anything that's more kind of like a political statement, where in itself graffiti writing is a political statement in the way that you're saying that I have an identity, I don't want it to be constrained or constructed by the rules of markets or capitalism, I just want it to exist. Where street art more so is specifically about a specific political subject or social issue. But street art, unfortunately, has like been co-opted a lot, where even if you think of people like Banksy, I don't see street art as always being done as like a pure intention. A lot of times you'll see someone even do something like a commentary on like stop the genocide in Gaza, and then they'll sign their name next to it. And it's like, why do you need a sign in your name? It's a lot of co-opting, where even in my own case where I've done political graffiti in the past, I just don't sign it. It's just I'm doing it for the movement, for the cause, where then sometimes you'll see people like Banksy or similar to Banksy, they'll do something like that. And it's just like super vague, and it's just a lot easier for people to consume, and people more readily look at the super abstracted, like incoherent street art and think, yeah, that's the thing that's saying something, where they'll look at graffiti, style writing, hip hop, and say, that's just trash, that's vandalism, where it's like, well, one of these here has a very pure intention of just saying, here's my identity, I want to be seen, I want to be understood this way. The other one saying, ooh, here's some cool imagery that is provocative or interesting in some way. I don't know what I'm saying, or I do know what I'm saying, and I want it to be rewarding for me somehow, even though I'm capitalizing off of a social issue. So it's very contentious within graffiti world.
Yeah, I can see it. So you used to be a graffiti writer, still are today, but you would spray paint unsanctioned graffiti writing and letters on places. Now you are also a professional artist and you are commissioned to do murals. What was that transition like from being a college kid painting gems to now getting paid for your art? Is there anything that you miss from the good old days?
Yeah, I mean, with graffiti writing, having my agency and over the name Gems is a bit freeing, obviously, where now since I was arrested for graffiti in 2017, I can't write the name Gems illegally in Pittsburgh anymore without it being tied back to me, and then I go to jail because I'm on probation for the rest of my life. As far as that transition, though, since I was arrested, initially I was looking at like 2 to 3 years and like $128,000 restitution, and I was just graduating college, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is going to ruin my life. I was kind of like, all right, I need to like make some money quick. So I started making some art pieces with Gems tags on them and things like that. And with this, I'm definitely not saying that like you need to be arrested and be a number one most wanted graffiti writer to start a mural career. It was more so like, okay, I owe a lot of money. I don't owe student loans, but I owe a lot of money. Better start making money somehow. I developed this following. People know me as Gems, and I can't write that name anymore. All right, then I'll just start using the name in a way that still gives me control over it, but not as in a freeing of a way. But if anything, what really pushed me into muralism was that I had put so many years into learning how to use spray paint and how to use it very quickly and use it in pitch black, so that when I started to do murals or was interested in murals, I was already like, had the can control. I had the ability to paint very quickly and just efficiently. And then my first mural was actually my first like proper official mural was for Central Outreach Wellness Center, which is a health clinic for LGBTQ people and addicts and users on the North Shore. And since then they've branched out to having many locations, and I've actually done tons of murals for them, and now they're my PCP. And so I definitely owe them a lot of thanks for that. But just kind of a lot of getting into muralism is just getting used to rejection and just approaching every business owner and saying, hey, I notice your building keeps getting tagged. You want a permanent solution to it? Let me do a spray can art mural on it. And yeah, from there, like the more murals you get, the more you get, just because it's advertisement for itself. And you can't really start to build that portfolio until you show what you're capable of doing. So if you approach some company or some store owner and they say, what does your work look like? And you're like, good. Trust me. Like, it doesn't really work that way. Like, you just have to have work under your belt.
Do you think working with the community and working with youth has been really fulfilling? I know that is kind of the direction some of your mural making has started taking.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely prefer to do the murals that are very community oriented. Probably like 2 years ago, I was doing a lot of just very quick commercial murals, a lot of like mom and pop shops and smaller brands and stuff, and also some larger like corporate clients like Sheetz and Dick's Sporting Goods and stuff like that. So I think in 1 year, myself and my business partner Shane probably did like maybe like 70 murals in a year, which is like nuts. Yeah, and like some of them were like very quick whatever thing. Some of them we got paid barely anything, but we were just kind of like very hungry at that point. We were like, yeah, let's just go. And that did help build our portfolio. But one of our goals now is to start finding more clients that pay better. And then we've just been handing off a lot of those jobs to our friends because we actually run a website, dowhatwelove.com. So anytime we can't take on a job or we're like, oh, that's not really like our thing or whatever, we're like, cool, we'll transfer you over to our painting partner, Jerome or Brian or whoever. And so we've been able to like not reject all these like mom and pop shops, but just kind of like take a little pressure off ourselves. And for some of the projects that are like more community involved, like some of those are ones where we get a grant or there's an RFQ and like we apply for these things. And sometimes they have really good funding, which is great because then we can devote a lot of our time to them. where unfortunately sometimes some community-oriented things just have zero funding. And anytime there is a social cause, though, like if someone has passed away due to like police violence or like, or anyone's passed away, really, like we try to offer up our services and be like, hey, we have the paint, we have the resources, just tell us where, tell us when, we'll show up, do it, and just knock it out in a day. And like, but yeah, like I would love to start doing much, many more community-oriented, like long-term projects rather than just like a drop-in, meet some kids one day, be like, what's up, children? I'm here to paint a mural. Like, might not ever see you again. Good luck. I'd love to actually like be there for like a month at a time and like really focus in on the community and like do more than just have it serve as a commercial function.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really like seeing cool graffiti around the city, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners feel the same. Where in the city should we go if we want to see the cool spots for graffiti lettering?
Yeah, I mean, so we actually created Pittsburgh's only legal sanctioned graffiti space in Bloomfield on the side of Trace Brewing. So if you just Google search Graffiti Alley, it pops up, and you can actually go there anytime, paint whatever, go over whatever. And we've actually had a few friends like start their mural careers there. Because you can just paint anything, take a photo, crop it, and show that to a potential client so that when they ask, what does your work look like, you can show them all these images and they don't need to know it's all the same site. You just say Bloomfield. Yeah, so that's a cool place to, like, one, like, meet a lot of the graffiti community, because you'll at least meet one person while you're down there that's, like, from the community. And then we also revamped Color Park recently on the south side, where we had them install like actual walls built out of concrete blocks. So that's another site where you can do the same thing. There's not quite as many like graffiti writers or muralists that go there. A lot of that's just kind of like general community, but those are two cool spots where like if you're actually looking to paint, and it doesn't matter like what skill level you are like at all, like you can paint there. Garfield as a neighborhood has a lot of really cool graffiti, especially like Penn Avenue, First Friday area.
So kind of on that topic of the art scene in Pittsburgh, how would you say that the graffiti scene and the art scene, are they just one scene, or are they two separate communities that sometimes interact, or is there a complete division between the two?
I would say in Pittsburgh, there's definitely a complete division, just because since Pittsburgh graffiti writers have been like so pushed to the outskirts of society due to like it's like all the like prosecution and persecution of graffiti in Pittsburgh, a lot of those people don't see themselves as like normally functioning part of society. And like so if anything, they're pretty adverse to art. And sometimes when they'll even see someone get into visual arts or try to do an art show or whatever, they'll be like disgusted by it, like, oh, you're a sellout or whatever. And the older you get, though, the more everyone understands, like, okay, like you have a family, you got to support whoever, and you grow up at some point. But Pittsburgh's slowly adapting to that, slowly getting used to like having its graffiti writers put on art shows. Although First Friday is like one of the few places that you'll see a lot of the graffiti writers present with a lot of the art scene, just because it is like so grassroots. But a lot of the art scene just doesn't know anything about the graffiti scene. And doesn't know that Pittsburgh actually has this like super long history of like graffiti writing and important figures from here, or things started from here. Like even like the most important graffiti documentary, Style Wars, it was put out on PBS 1983. Like Henry Chalfant, the director of that, he's from Swickley, PA, so like 30 minutes outside Pittsburgh. His nephew lives in Garfield, and like we actually brought him out here to do a screening of his film at the Carnegie Museum of Art. And yeah, and it's just kind of like, it's nuts that this guy who's internationally famous for his film gets like zero recognition in Pittsburgh from the arts community. And he found all of his success in New York. Yeah, just like definitely not much interest from the fine art scene in the graffiti scene.
Well, hopefully that's going to, you know, change in the future, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pittsburgh is notoriously behind the times on many things, which is one reason why like I have my mural career, because it's just starting off here, the mural scene. where every other city it had started like in the 90s. So Pittsburgh is like just starting to accept graffiti art, muralism, and just kind of like the aesthetics of graffiti. So Pittsburgh is like just starting to like accept like the culture of it as well.
Sure, yeah. I think that's just about all the time we have, but you've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Again, I'm one of your hosts, Archon Das, with
Kate Smiggy.
And we've been talking to Max Gonzalez, graffiti artist. Thanks, Max. Has been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we begin with a conversation about capitalism's relationship with democracy and fascism in the U.S. today.
Our guest is Professor Richard Wolff, who the New York Times has said is probably America's most able Marxist economist.
We talked with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges about his book, American Fascists. Is there still time to halt the growing fascistic movement in America and preserve a meaningful measure of our threatened democracy?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The great German playwright and political figure Bertolt Brecht observed that to understand fascism, you have to understand capitalism from whence it springs. Today, it is also helpful to us to understand that the rise of fascism in Germany 100 years ago has parallels that we can now see with respect to the rise of fascism here in the United States. Prior to World War I, which began in 1914, the German working class and middle class were relatively prosperous. The German unions were strong and influential. Prior to World War I, Germany also had the largest and strongest socialist party in the world, and it was the second largest political party in the German parliament. The German economy was booming, and German culture was the jewel of Europe. This all came to a crashing end in 1917, when Germany was defeated. in what was an inter-imperial war against the United States, France, Great Britain, and Russia. The consequences of that defeat brought us fascism and World War II 20 years later. In the 1920s, inflation wiped out the savings of the German people. And when the Depression hit in 1929, the German working class was desperate. The ground was fertile for the rise of Adolf Hitler, a ruthless, cunning, and violent demagogue. Here in the United States, our economy boomed for 100 years, from the end of the Civil War until the 1970s. But since then, American workers have not made any progress. Their wages, in fact, in real terms, have not risen in 50 years. Neoliberalism, which is just another word for aggressive capitalism, has wiped out 30 million industrial jobs in the United States starting in the 1980s. Women were driven back into the workforce. People had to work two jobs just to keep up. In Germany, it was the Jews who were blamed. Here in the United States, it is immigrants and people of color who are scapegoated. The demagogue Trump, like Hitler before him, is a captivating speaker and a very effective cult leader who is now poised to take the power of the government and turn it against we the people. So we will talk today with our returning guest economist, Richard Wolff, Professor Wolff from the University of Massachusetts and the author of the forthcoming book, Understanding Capitalism. According to the New York Times, Richard Wolff is, and I quote, probably America's most prominent Marxist economist. Well, Richard Wolff, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
All right, sir. Now, Richard, you know, you've so held much of your life, your intellectual life, certainly studying, teaching, writing about capitalism. And in fact, you have a new book coming out titled Understanding Capitalism. So let's talk about capitalism's relationship to democracy and relationship to fascism here in the U.S. and, of course, 100 years ago in Germany.
My pleasure. I'd be glad to. It's, you know, it's one of those urgent topics that almost escapes attention because it either overwhelms people or they think it's ancient history, and it isn't. It's very applicable to the immediate crises that we face.
So explain that to us. Why do you believe that is the case?
Well, capitalism is a system that has built into it at least two fundamental qualities that produce one crisis after another. And the first of those qualities is inequality. In other words, capitalism is a system that produces extreme wealth at one end, you know, Elon Musk's and people like that, and then a vast army of people who are barely make ends meet, which is, you know, the bottom two-thirds of the American people, and the same is true in most other capitalist countries. When you produce inequality like that, and you reproduce it generation by generation, you also produce enormous social tension. On the part of the mass of people, you produce bitterness, anger, resentment, envy, all of those things that go into being on the short end of the stick and seeing your parents in that position and your children in that position. On the other hand, among the few who are rich, you get this kind of anxiety that they understand very well that they are the rich surrounded by a sea of people who are bitter about it. And so they turn to the police and the military, desperate to protect what they have against all. In other words, built into this system is a level of conflict and tension that periodically explodes. And the forms of explosion go everywhere from the individual act of violence against a family member, against a neighbor, against a coworker, when the pressures of being in debt and the pressures of being unable to afford to put food on the table blow up a person's tolerability. We are all human. We can only take so much. Then there are revolutions. Then there are workers who go on strike. But on the other side of the coin, then there are the people who want a government that will protect them, that will have the streets full of police and military, monitoring everything we do, controlling everything we do, punishing the slightest infraction. And when that process goes far enough, you call it fascism. It takes that particular form in which the government is brought in as a kind of day-by-day partner to the business community, the employer class, to impose and enforce the capitalist system, because the mass of people either don't want it, don't stand it, can't tolerate it, or are beginning to rumble that they want change. And capitalism keeps producing it. It produced it in Europe in the last century multiple times. We had it in the 1930s so badly, in the names of Mussolini and Hitler and others, that we had a world war, killed, 40, 50 million people coming out of the challenge of fascism to try to become the next phase of human history. So it's always lurking, and it always looks at beginnings of tension as a chance to justify its argument that you have to do that to save the people at the top. In Germany, this was all organized around demonizing Jews and certain other groups of minorities. Nowadays, it's organized around demonizing immigrants and other minorities. It always finds some scapegoats because it doesn't want to answer the question, why is our society torn apart, by answering, it's our capitalist system, because that's a taboo, and so you look for an alternative explanation, and then there are the usual scapegoats, and that's what fascism distinguishes itself about. It goes after those scapegoats and literally kills them.
Rick, what did the economic policies of neoliberalism do to the American working class?
Well, the major thing, there are several. Economic liberalism, for lack of a better term, something that became dominant again in the 1970s. It had been dominant earlier, by the way. That's why it's called neoliberalism, because it's the newer version, but it's an old business. This is the idea that the economy will work best if you leave it in the hands of the employer class. The U.S. Census today says 3% of the American people are employers. The rest of us are employees. So in other words, if you leave you take liberalism seriously, then you put into the driver's seat of society the 3% of people who employ the rest of us. And that idea leads you then to have the very inequalities I just mentioned. And you also have, very serious, a kind of built-in instability. Every 4 to 7 years, capitalist economic systems everywhere in the world crash. Sometimes the economic downturn, and by the way, it's called a recession or a depression or a crisis or a correction. I mean, they're endless terms because this is always with us in capitalism. Every 4 to 7 years, sometimes it only lasts a few months, sometimes it lasts 10 years. Sometimes it only throws 1 million people out of work, sometimes it throws 50 million people out of work. In other words, capitalism is a system that not only produces and reproduces huge inequality, it's also unstable. And unstable on a scale and on a level that makes people really bitter and angry. And what you saw over the last 30 to 40 years, the neoliberalism, that corporations got the control here in America. They pushed back on what the New Deal had achieved. They undid the New Deal in the 40 years afterwards. And then they went to town, and they did three crucial things. Number one, they moved production out of the United States to other parts of the world where labor was cheaper, above all Asia and above all China. Number two, they replaced expensive workers with automation, the computer, the robot, and now artificial intelligence. These two things destroyed tens of millions of jobs and dumped the people who lost those jobs into very bad situations for themselves, for the families that depended on them, for the communities that depended on those families. And you basically split the United States into the minority that did well by moving production to Europe, or to Asia, excuse me, and the majority that are looking around trying to figure out what happened. That's why Mr. Trump is successful with a slogan like MAGA, because it's a fancified notion of a good old days that are now gone. The good old days weren't that good, and they didn't disappear by some magic. That was a decision of capitalists in America to go to where the profit was highest, which is what they always do, and now it meant leaving the United States, and the working class is stuck with the result. It's very bitter, and so the ruling class has to turn to fascistic ways of keeping control. That's what the Trump administration and the Trump campaign is all about. That's what the 2025 plan is all about. These are the steps taken when the capitalist system once again finds the inequality and the instability bringing to the edge of the sustainability of their system, and then they turn to force, to violence, in a word, to fascism.
Richard, following along on what you were just talking about, and you mentioned Trump, he, of course, has the political and financial support of, well, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, both billionaires 100 times over, and a lot of folks like him. And, for that matter, Harris has the support of Wall Street, too. Talk to us again about why they enjoy that kind of support and what that really means.
I'll be diplomatic. The employer class of our country understood that they don't want to be altogether identified with one party or the other party. The reason is that then the working class might figure out that the way to defeat the employer class, to make their wages better, to make their job security stronger, and so on, was to line up behind the other party. The whole origin of socialist political parties in Europe and here in the United States was premised on the notion that since the vast majority of people are in the working class, socialism should appeal to them. It's what's for them rather than for the capitalists, and so that they would organize a political party. The risk, of course, was that the mass of workers would understand it that way too, and would vote for the Socialist Party, which in many parts of the world, including here in the United States, large numbers of workers did. If you go back to the American Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, socialist parties in the 1930s, they were beginning to pick up large numbers of sympathies and voters and all the rest. So the people at the top understood, how about a better system? We have two parties, and we make the whole political system be a contest between the two, but we make both of them dependent on us, so that neither of them can afford to alienate us, to upset us, to pursue laws or rules or regulations that limit or constrain us. We'll make them both us, and therefore we can throw out one when people get antsy and bring in the other one. And then when nothing really changes and they get angry at the one we brought in, we say, okay, we'll give you the other party. And we go back and forth in exactly the way that the Republicans and Democrats have been doing for years in this country. And I think that's what you see. You get the Democratic Party is dependent on huge donors that are of one frame of mind, and the Republican Party is on the other. So that the one thing that the candidates on both sides have in common is they never have a critical word to say about capitalism. if you think about it, it's actually extraordinary. They will talk about a problem over here or there in housing or in tariffs or in price gouging or whatever else they might occasionally talk about. But when they do, it's never the capitalist system that is part of the problem, let alone the key part of the problem. And so they come up with little piecemeal reforms and suggestions, which either pass or don't, and in any case do not solve the problem. I mean, let me give you just one stark example. The minimum wage in this country, the federal minimum wage, is $7.25 an hour. That was last raised to that lofty level in the year 2009. That's 15 years ago. During every one of the 15 years since then, prices have gone up in the United States for milk and eggs and coffee and gasoline and everything else. But what we pay the poorest of the poor workers in America remained the same, $7.25, so they could, of course, afford less and less with each passing year. Republican presidents did that. Democratic presidents did it. Republican Congresses did it. Democratic Congresses did it. Somehow, with all the differences we're supposed to believe exist between them, when it came to something that a lot of capitalists want, namely cheap labor, suddenly magic, they couldn't find a disagreement about it. It's really extraordinary when you watch it. We have no opposition to capitalism that's allowed to play any kind of role. We have a duopoly, a system of politics that makes it impossible for third parties to get off the ground. And that's carefully done to make sure that this theater, in which you have a debate, in which you can say with a straight face that you're worried about immigrants eating pets, but you cannot discuss capitalism. That is weird in a world in which capitalism is everywhere understood to be a system in a lot of problem and a lot of crisis right now.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner. The two of us are co-hosting Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with the economist Richard Wolff, who's just written a book called Understanding Capitalism, a wonderful book. Rick, the countervailing forces that could potentially fight fascism in this country are fairly weak, but they exist. There's an upsurge in the union movement. The Palestine solidarity efforts are remarkable. We had the Black Lives Matter movement and the Occupy movement. This brought about the popular notion of the 1% as opposed to the rest of us, the 99%. And lately we had the Bernie Sanders phenomena. Socialism is no longer a dirty word in America. How do you appreciate all of this?
More and more of these young people, and particularly the young, but the older ones too, they are really demanding change. The old socialist dream, which always was expressible in this phrase, we can do better than capitalism. That instinct is what took people who lived in slavery and finally allowed them to say, we've had it with this system, it has to go, and it did. And the same thing happened with the serfs in feudalism. This has to go, and it did. And we shouldn't be all that surprised that sooner or later, after perhaps a dozen false starts, a mass movement will say, we can do better than capitalism. We don't have to divide ourselves into 3% of the people who are employers and 97% who are employees, so that the employers enrich themselves, keep the power for themselves. And we're all wondering, well, how secure our job is, whether we can give an education to our children. This is not a necessary way, any more than slavery was necessary or serfdom was necessary. And I think you're seeing that. And I think those movements that you mentioned are precisely the signs in various communities that sooner or later, this system's contradictions will blow it up. the labor movement isn't new. You know, it's 100 years old, 200 years old in this country, and older in Europe. They've been fighting the employer for a long time. They've had a longer history, and they've done better, by the way, than American workers have. I want to remind everyone that we here in this country don't have what working class struggles, usually led by socialists, were able to achieve, for example, in Western Europe. I'm still amazed as a professor, born and raised in America and taught in American universities all my life, when I explain that in France, for example, when you graduate high school, and you take a job, the law requires the employer to give you 5 weeks of paid vacation from day one. Doesn't depend on who your union is or isn't. Doesn't depend on who your employer is. It's the law. Socialists got that law. Higher education in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, is effectively free. No tuition, no fees. Why? Because the socialist movement fought for those things. Americans can't even imagine it, and that's partly because the socialism has been kept at bay by defining politics as if it went no further than what you saw last night.
And certainly you've made the point that both of the political parties that dominate the scene in this country, the Republicans and Democrats, they're both capitalist parties. And both of the candidates for president, whether it be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, are also have that philosophy, that political economic philosophy. But in the context of the growing fear of fascism in this country, do you not think there is a qualitative political difference there between, well, between Trump and Harris? I know a good many people on the left do. They argue there is a great deal of a difference. They say, well, you know, Trump, along with the fascistic nationalism of that Project 2025 report that you referenced, would represent, if you were elected, a further big, dangerous step towards fascism in America, or at the very least, the coming of an authoritarian president if Trump is elected. So what are your thoughts on that, given that, nevertheless, both candidates are themselves capitalists from capitalist parties?
Well, my sense is the following. Sometimes the little difference is the only difference you can grab hold of, and I think we're in that situation. Mr. Trump seems to be very comfortable imagining a fascistic turn in the United States, especially one with him at the helm. He idolizes leaders around the world who have also taken steps in that direction. He clearly is a Republican. He clearly favors capital over labor. He doesn't understand most of the issues that are involved there other than from an employer point of view. So, yeah, I think he would be the easiest, quickest convert to a fascistic solution as the problems arise for which this capitalism in America is so poorly prepared to deal. I think the difference is that Kamala Harris would take a little longer. She might be a bit more hesitant to make those moves. If you're asking me, is she capable of ending up in a similar place? I don't have the slightest doubt that she is. She has been part of this system all of her life, certainly all of her adult life, and there's no reason to doubt that she would. But I think that the real question is, and that has always been the case, will the mass of the people allow either of them, and I mean either of them, to go in that direction? The union movement isn't going to do that. Black Lives Matter isn't going to do that. The Palestinian people concerned about the horror there, are those movements going to grow? Are those movements going to converge and become a power together? Let me give an example right now, because people wonder, oh, that's a pie in the sky. The last national election in France, which was literally a few weeks ago, saw a remarkable development in a country not that different from the United States. 4 different left-wing political parties. The French Socialist Party, the French Communist Party, the French Green Party, and the largest of them, a party known as France Unbowed. led by a Marxist, former communist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They ran for office. They're now the number one political party in France. They have the largest number of seats. Mr. Macron, who's we hear is the leader of France, came in third out of three major parties. He's finished politically, and the left, when it unified, is now in a dominant, powerful position in the French government. And this is not pie in the sky and not fanciful notion. If the left in the United States can overcome its narrowness, its division into too many little groups, and it can become focused, it will be the determinant of whether any fascism takes root again in the United States, or whether instead capitalism will have to find an alternative way to solve its problems rather than to degenerate into a fascism the way it did when it couldn't solve its problems in Italy or France or Spain or Japan in the last century that we saw with such devastating effects. That's the issue. That's why what happens on the left in the United States is a crucial. And the understanding that capitalism is the problem is why, not only why I wrote the book, but why I thought it could contribute to an overcoming of what's holding back the best bet we have to prevent fascism.
Richard Wolff, it's been terrific having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to go, can you tell people how can they get your book, Understanding Capitalism, and how can people keep up with your work?
Well, the answer to both questions is the same, and it's very simple. Just go to our website, and it's called democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracy at work, no punctuation, democracyatwork.info. There you will find out about the new book, Understanding Capitalism, and everything else we do to make these arguments and to disseminate them globally.
Well, my goodness. Richard Wolff, again, we thank you so much. It's always the pleasure to have you here on Law and Disorder. Thank you for being with us again and for so clearly and passionately explaining what is at stake.
Okay, and my hat's off to both of you and all of you for maintaining this program. It's one of the ways to get these issues put on the table, which is more necessary now than ever before.
Richard Wolff, a million thanks for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics, perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed programmatically, and not animated by any kind of cadre of capable administrators. It was instead full of his statements and actions that many critics deemed to be racist, sexist, and xenophobic. He lost the election in 2020, although he did receive 74 million votes. And as he runs for the presidency again, this time he is talking, well, rather openly about wanting dictatorial authority, if indeed he is elected. And this time, if he does win, he now also has the aid of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced that 900-page Project 2025 document on how to radically change our country so as to make it far, far more conservative, provide far fewer rights to the American people, and allow any president so inclined to run the country as a virtual dictator. He has the financial support of a number of billionaires. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Donald Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed him above the law, allowing the president to do almost anything he or she might want to do as long as it's deemed to be an official presidential act. And so today's program is the lead-off to a series of shows about fascism. Experts will discuss what it is, how it can be resisted, and how one organizes to make that resistance meaningful. We're going to start this series with today's guest, who is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a wise and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a moral and political philosopher as well. He has written a book